Good afternoon. So last time we started delving into how schedulers, in particular processor schedulers, things which divide up CPU time among the different threads that we have to run, we went into how XP6's scheduler code worked and had this design where, for convenience of programming, probably they have a separate scheduler thread. So you switch to that scheduler thread, and that scheduler thread was just writing a loop where it would switch to one thread, then another, and so on. We saw that there were some details with respect to how you did that switch, and one thing we need to worry about is what if we trigger a switch from, you know, some event like waiting for I/O, and at the same time, another event also triggers a switch, like we have a timer interrupt telling us to switch away from the current program. That could result in us being confused about what programs are running and whether we're in the middle of a switch or not. So to deal with that, we used a lock, which we'll talk about how that works later, which happened to disable interrupts while we were changing those thread states. So we didn't have to worry about having that confusion of switching while switching. We also mentioned generally that when we're talking about scheduling the CPU, we're going to talk about thread scheduling. Because thread is the part that goes in a processor core. It's the registers, the program counter, stack pointer, and so on. But in XP6, this is kind of conflated with process scheduling because each process has exactly one thread, so they're the same problem in XP6, but this is not true in a more general operating system. So after we looked at how XP6 actually scheduled things, we saw that there didn't seem to be an actual sort of design decision about this is the best thing to run next. They just chose what was most convenient for their code. So we started thinking about, well, how are we going to figure out what makes sense to run next, what's better than the other? And for that, we needed a model of, well, what are our programs doing anyways? And our model for things like desktops or laptops was this notion of CPU burst, that programs are alternating between doing a little bit of computation and doing I/O so they can do more computation, like waiting for us to press a key, waiting for some data to come on the network. And after they get that, they're going to process in response to that for a little bit. So we have these, what we called CPU burst. And these are what we're scheduling. And where the scheduling problem is interesting is when we have multiple applications, all of which want to run some CPU bursts. So we needed some way of comparing, you know, how good is one scheduling decision versus another. So we have these metrics. So two metrics that we talked about are related to some notion of how quickly do things get run. So we had turnaround time, which is what's the time from when things were runnable, so usually an I/O finished, like I pressed a key, to when they finish running, to when they're waiting for their next I/O. And wait time, which is just basically another way of measuring the same thing, same kind of thing of what's the time from when something was ready to run until when it was finished that it wasn't actually using the CPU. How much time did we spend running other things when it was still had work to do? So we also talked about metrics which, you know, are going to be conflicting with these turnaround time. So one of those was throughput. That's the amount of useful work done per unit time. And, you know, it might seem from our first approximation, well, if we're using the CPU all the time, we're getting all the work we can get done. But that's not true because some of the stuff we're doing in scheduling, we don't think of as useful work. And the biggest one was context switching. We also have other costs, like if I have to do a lot of computation to decide what to run next, that's going to be, you know, what we called overhead, things that aren't useful work that are going to lower the amount of work we actually get done. And we had a last consideration we mentioned of fairness. And the idea of fairness is that, well, some schedules are going to disadvantage certain programs, and we started off with a model that like each user has one program, even though maybe that's very rarely true these days. That used to be the case. But some schedules are going to favor one program or one user over others, and we might not like that. We might want to have some notion of everything gets treated at least kind of similarly. And those were just some examples of metrics. There's a whole bunch of others we could talk about, and many of them are more subjective. So fairness starts getting pretty subjective. We can come up with specific definitions, but like there's, you know, there's a notion that we have in our heads that is hard to write down in a way where I can compute a number and say, this is less, we're good. And there's lots of other metrics we'll think about as far as that. So for today, I'm going to be spending most of my time focusing on how we can schedule to minimize mean or total turnaround time. I have, or because if we minimize mean turnaround time, we minimize total turnaround time because there's so many things running, you know, so the total is just, the mean is just the total divided by the number of things running, so they're the same. Same to minimize, or not the same number. And the reason we'll focus on this is because this is an imperfect approximation of sort of interactivity or responsiveness on something like a desktop or a laptop or a phone. So, but why is it imperfect? What's an example of something where, you know, this metric is not actually what we care about if we're thinking about how responsive is my app desktop or how interactive, you know, is my phone? So we're talking about minimizing time from when events happen to when the program that's responding to that input gets to finish. What's a reason why this might not match my notion of, I said you in front of two machines, one of which has a better scheduler for this metric, why might you be dissatisfied with a better scheduler? Like, what could be happening? Yeah?
Maybe if you're playing like a game on your laptop and you get some like push notification, you don't necessarily want it to happen like right away.
So our scheduler doesn't actually distinguish between what type of events are being responded to. So yeah. So you're saying your example is like a game, like responding to like my key presses and mouse presses, versus something doing something based on the network. Like this metric doesn't distinguish between that. It says they're equally important. And that probably doesn't match your idea of what's important. Like, and there are other mismatches like that. So this is imperfect. Yeah, and the biggest complaint is that like we aren't actually measuring what you see. We're measuring just input to finish, regardless of what it's for. We also aren't doing relative importance. Like if I have my web browser open in the background and Skype, you know, probably I care more about Skype being slow than my web browser, but this metric says they're equally important. So we're going to start by talking about two trivial scheduling algorithms, which don't seem to do anything with metrics. They're not making any direct choices about trying to be good for a metric, like turnaround time, but we'll look at what do they actually do for turnaround time, and from that, we're going to come up with a plan for actually minimizing turnaround time. And these two trivial schedulers are something called first come, first served, and round robin. And I'll start with first come, first serve, because it's probably the simplest possible scheduler, and you can probably guess how it works. I'm going to give several examples of schedulers, and we're going to keep things nice and simple to start out here and say that we're assuming that multiple programs become ready at almost the same time. So they're all just ready to do their CPU burst, some I/O finished almost the same time, but there's some order. So one was first, one was second, like it was all like in the same microsecond or millisecond, but you know, there's some order, and that order is going to be important. And the reason the order is going to be important for first come, first served is because first come, you know, that's going to matter. So first come, first served. Let's look at that. So this is going to have no preemption. So when we talked about like context switching for like things running too long in XP6, we had like a timer interrupt. The program was running normally, and we stopped it and ran something else. First come, first served, we're not going to do that. We're going to keep running the program until it can't keep running. We're not going to, you know, not run anything else, but the program's going to run until like it does I/O or something like that. And sometimes you might have to do this. Some machines, you don't have a good context switch. Like, maybe you can context switch, but you need to, like, it's really expensive. Or maybe you can only context switch when the program sets itself up to save its state. So you might have to do this, but that's what we're doing. And it's the simplest because, you know, we're not preempting. And otherwise, we're going to make the simplest choice of run the first thing that came in. Then run the next thing which came. We're just going to keep a list, go to the next thing in the list. So let's give an example of how this works. And here I have a list of my threads that I'm running. And I'm saying that we're going to know how much CPU time each of them needs. And I'm just telling you it's 24, 4, and 3 units. So the scheduler doesn't actually know this. This is just for the example so I can like figure out what's going to happen. And from this list of times, you can get that, well, A is kind of a compute bound. It's doing some big computation relative to everything else. And B and C are kind of what we might call interactive. They're, you know, doing little bits of computation in response to I/O, probably the sorts of things like a shell. You know, I just type something, it needs to do a little computation to set up what it's going to do, then it's done. Like to print out the list of files or whatever I'm asking it to do. So if these arrive in the order A, B, C, we have A runs first for 24 units, then B for 4, then C for the last few. And we can compute our wait and turnaround times for this. So turnaround time is time when things became ready. And I told you at the beginning, we're assuming everything becomes ready at once at time 0 to when it finishes. So for A, it started at time 0, finished at time 24, 24 units. For B, it was ready at time 0, so it started waiting or /running and finished everything up at time 28. So it had a turnaround time of 28. And similarly, C had a turnaround time of 31. If we average those together, we get 27.7. Another measurement that we could use, which is basically equivalent for the mean, except we just subtract a constant, is that we can take the wait time, which is the time from when things started to when they finished that they weren't running. So for A, it ran immediately, so it has a wait time of 0. For B, it had to wait for A, so it has a wait time of those 24 units during which A was running. And for C, it had to wait for A and B, so it's a wait time of the 24 plus 4 units during which A and B were running. So first come, first served is really sensitive to how long it took, what order things ran in, came in, and how long they take. So in this case, A took a really long time and came first, and that had a big effect. If A instead came last, then we get this very different schedule where B and C run first, and we have very different wait and turnaround times. So here, B has a wait time of 0 because it came first. It didn't have to wait for anyone. C has a wait time of only 4 because it only had to wait for B. And A has a wait time of 7 because it had to wait for B and C. In the turnaround times, we just take the wait time out of the amount of time things were actually running. And we have a mean turnaround time of 14 instead of 27. You know, so this is, from that perspective, a lot better. And we'll come back later to looking at the ordering. But what we can see happening with the quote-unquote wrong order is something you might know as a convoy effect, is that, you know, everyone's waiting behind this long thing, this long thread A, you know, sort of groups up. And this just sort of happens naturally when we have some long things and some short things, and we run them one at a time, so that we're going to have a bunch of things group up behind the long thing. And that's going to be our primary cause of not having really good turnaround times. And one way you could think about this is, well, you know, we kind of, you know, we were in trouble with our restrictions of no preemption, of not interrupting anything that's already running, as soon as we decided to run A. So next I'll look at the scheduler where we say, well, we're going to do preemption. We're not just going to say, I ran something, can't switch away from it now, with round robin. So round robin is the simplest, basically preemptive scheduling algorithm. So it's preemptive, meaning we are willing to stop programs after we've started them, even if they are still ready to run more CPU time. And in round robin, we're either going to run the program until it's done, until it doesn't need the CPU right now, or it runs for too long. And we have to make a decision about how long too long is. For round robin, we're going to choose a number called a time quantum. And that's going to be how long we're going to let programs run. If they run for longer than that, we're going to stop them. So this requires us to do preemption. So it requires some extra, you know, support from the OS. We need a way to interrupt programs to enforce that time quantum. So XP6 has the timer interrupt. And we need a good way of like switching away from programs while they're running, in addition to interrupting them, which we have with XP6 as efficient context switches. So let's look at how this might work with our same example, but with a time quantum of 1 unit. So in this model, our program, our program here gets to run, you know, A, then B, then C, because our time quantum is 1. So A runs for 1 unit, then B, then C, then A, then B, then C. And eventually, C finishes. C required 3 units of work. So after 3 repeats, we run A, then B, but then we run A again because we don't have any reason to run C. We also finish up B because B, at point time 11, has ran 1, 2, 3, 4 units, which is all it needed to do before it went to its next I.O. So after that point, we only had A to run. So even though we have a time quantum of 1, well, A finishes up its 1 unit of work, and then we say, what else can we run? And we look on our list and we say, we can run A. So we run A again, even though our time quantum is 1. And with a different order, we do get a slightly different schedule. So with the order BCA, we run B and C a little sooner, but we're still alternating between them, only running 1 unit of each at a time. So we end up finishing B 1 unit of time sooner, and we end up finishing C at this basically the same time. So this is the sort of what we get for waiting time. So for waiting times, we can compute them directly by saying, well, A finishes here and started and was ready at time 0, and there was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 units of time during which A could have run but wasn't. And for B, we can say, okay, B was ready at time 0, and there was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 units of time during which B could have run but didn't. So I get those waiting times. We could also get the turnaround time. So for B, B was ready at time 0, finished at time 11, so its turnaround time is 11. And we could compute its wait time by saying, well, B ran for 4 units of time. So 11 minus 4 is 7 is its wait time. That would be another way of computing that. And we can see with round robin, not surprisingly, because these schedules just look much more similar than our first come first serve ones, we have much more similar wait and turnaround times, and we're not very sensitive to the order. Now, here, I made a particular choice of what the time quantum is, and that is a real choice. We have to think about, well, should I do 1 unit, 2 units, 3 units? And obviously, our real units, we're going to think like milliseconds. Should I do like 100 microseconds, 1 millisecond, seconds? What should my time quantum be? And the time quantum's going to change what our schedule looks like. So if I make my time quantum larger, you know, I'm going to switch less between the programs, but also, you know, it's going to make the order matter more. So here with my larger time quantum, I have a similar schedule. You can see that C, the second time it runs, only uses 1 unit of time because that's all it had left to do. And in some sense, this looks like a little less fair than this. Here, when the programs can all run, they're all sharing the CPU perhaps more equally. If you look at any unit in time with the larger time quantum, they aren't. So questions about setup for round robin? Okay, so that's the round robin policy. So we need to choose that time quantum and do this. And this is basically what the XC6 scheduler does. Now, you might say, wait a moment, I didn't see any time quantum in the XV6 scheduler. How is that chosen? So the quantum is approximately the timer interrupt interval. And there's this little nit that if a program starts between two timer interrupts, it gets less than the full time quantum, which is sometimes a compromise some of these schedulers will make, sometimes not. Interrupt, timer, interrupts, gets a little less time. But other than that little change of like not precisely measuring the time quantums, this is what the XV6 scheduler implements. It's just kind of hard-coded in there, and they don't explicitly set the time quantum. They just say it's whatever the timer interrupt rate is. Whereas someone who's actually like choosing the time quantum deliberately will typically like either set their timer interrupt based on that explicitly, or count like the number of timer interrupts before they decide whether to yield away from a program or not. Yes?
If you want to reset the time quantum, you just have to recompile it.
So the question is in XV6, if I want to reset the time quantum?
Just in general. Right?
So in XV6, if you want to reset the time quantum, you need to change the code which configures the timer interrupt rate and recompile. For other OSs, this varies. So this used to be a major thing, which was hard-coded in Linux, for example, was the time quantum. But recent versions of Linux have made it more flexible. Usually on a OS which cares about the setting, they'll separate it from the timer interrupt rate. So they'll make the timer interrupt rate be something that's useful for keeping time. And they'll like have a counter that they use to figure out has enough time passed that I want to yield to another program. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So XV6 just chose whatever they set the timer interrupt to without really looking. How do you actually choose this? And one way of thinking about time quantums is thinking about the extreme. If I set the time quantum to infinity, I have first come, first served. First come, first served just never switches away, which means the time quantum never expires. If the time quantum is infinity, it never expires. So round robin becomes closer and closer to first come, first served, the bigger our time quantum is. And the shorter it is, other things happen. So one thing is that it becomes more fair in the sense that over short periods of time, every program gets the same amount of CPU time. The smaller time quantum is. Also, we have more context switches. So you saw that schedule I showed you with the time unit of one, we had way more context switches than when we were doing our first come first serve schedules. And that's going to mean lower throughput. So that's the reason why we don't want to set this too low, even if we really care about fairness, because we're going to approach the fairest possible scheduler, which is very boring. The fairest possible scheduler has never run anything. It's 100% fair. Everyone gets treated equally. No one gets to run. And we get closer and closer to that when we make the time quantum smaller, but that's not actually an acceptable situation of not running anyone ever. So we're not going to do that. We're going to set it large enough that we get a good amount of work done. Okay. And as for the fairness, like one way you can quantify the fairness is that if we have n processes and a time quantum of q, it's about n times q units of time until you run next, at most. So that's like proof that, you know, there's a way we can say it's more fair, like mathematically, for one definition. So I'd say, so what's a good setting here? And typically when people use schedulers that are round robin or based on round robin, they think about what's the context switch overhead? So we need to talk about what's the context switch overhead. And people have measured this, so relatively recent measurements say context switch overheads like 10 to 100 microseconds typically on something like a desktop. This is very hard to measure, so these measurements are trying to include what we call indirect costs, things like cache misses. Because when we context switch to one program and back to another, we've like cleared stuff out of the cache, that's going to make the program run slower, and these measurements are attempts to include that cost. But obviously that's both tricky to measure and it depends what program you're running. Some programs don't care about the cache, like they're doing everything in their registers or they're doing everything with the disk and the cache won't help. Some programs really care a whole lot. So the range could be wider than that by a lot, depending on what programs you're running. This is a typical range. And when we're choosing our time quantum, usually what people do is they think, okay, if that's the range, what overhead percentage am I happy with? And to give a concrete example, Linux's default is time quantum of 0.75 milliseconds to 6 milliseconds, which, you know, is one thought about this, and you think, well, if it's like order 3 milliseconds, you know, that overhead is like maybe, you know, 3 to less than 1%. And historically, common rates have been from 1 millisecond all the way to 100. And I think like this corresponds roughly to like 1% to 0.1% overhead. That's usually how people are trying to decide on this, is that, you know, they think 1% overhead is not too much, maybe even a couple more if you really care about, you know, letting things run fast, you know, in response to an event is not too much. So that's sort of how people choose this. So that's what we're going to choose just to manage that. Now, I told you now we have a way of choosing our fairness. And if we want to make things fair, we just set that as low as we can stand until the context switch overhead gets too high at time quantum. But what about turnaround or waiting time? So where should I choose on the spectrum if I care really about turnaround or waiting time? So let's have a little exercise on that. So let's ignore context switch overhead. So context switch overhead's a concern. And clearly, if we like decrease our time quantum to almost zero, then our turnaround time is going to go way up because we're spending all our time doing context switches, so everything's going to take a long time to finish. But ignoring context switch overheads, so assuming context switches are free, question here is, will decreasing the time quantum cause mean turnaround time to decrease, increase, stay the same, some what combination? I have my options here of, will it always increase or stay the same? Always decrease or stay the same? Could it do all of those? Could it increase or decrease or stay the same, depending on what you're doing? Or something else, like, will it always stay the same? Will it always increase? Well, does it depend on how you're measuring it? I'll give you a couple minutes to think over this, check with your neighbor if you agree. You should try to come up with examples to like show that you're, which cases you think are correct or not. Okay, who would like more time? Okay. So who thinks A? Okay, B? C? Okay, D? So we have a plurality for C, and I agree that's the answer I have. So I'll give some examples of each of these. So for increasing the mean turnaround time, here's the simplest example I could find. We have two things that take one unit of time. They're both ready at the same time, like in the examples we've shown before. And here, when my time quantum is 1, I run A and then B. So my mean turnaround time is the average of 1 and 2, 1 and a half. If my time quantum is 1 half, I run A for half a unit, B for half a unit, A for half a unit, B for half a unit. So A finishes later and B finishes at the same time. So the mean turnaround time increases a little bit. For decreasing, I'm going to use an example where I don't have the exact same amount of time for each thing, where I have A, which in this case needs 10 units, B needs just 1, and A happens to be first. And you can see with 10, we run A and then B. With 5, we run A for a bit, then run B, and then run A. So A finishes a little later, but B finishes a lot earlier. So this decreases the turnaround time by a lot. As for staying the same, there's a bunch of examples for that. One is that if my time quantum's larger than how long things want to run, nothing changes if I decrease it a little bit. Another example that's trivial is if there's only one thing to run, then your time quantum doesn't matter. So that's that. So we can see that changing this time quantum's not going to let us manipulate turnaround time. But we can look at our earlier examples of first come, first served in order to come up with how we're going to optimize our turnaround time. And we kind of saw a hint of this in my example of decreasing the turnaround time, that the problem when the time quantum was big is that the thing which didn't need much time was running late. And by running it earlier, we improved the turnaround time. And we're going to take that to a further extreme. So here I have three different arrival orders for first come, first served. And when we have the thing which takes the longest first, we get the longest turnaround time. And if we think of why this is happening, longest mean turnaround time, is because B and C both are waiting while A is running. And that's more time spent waiting than when, say, B and A are waiting while C is running. And that means, in general, we want to run the shortest thing first. We want this CBA order here because this means that, if we have to do something that's going to cause two things to wait, we want them to wait as little as possible. And that means running the thing which will finish soonest. So questions about how this comes about? So the best first come first served order for turnaround time is always to run the shortest CPU burst first. So one way of thinking about this is that we want to not have things waiting, so we want to get something to stop waiting as soon as possible, what we might call a race to sleep. Now we want some thread to go to sleep as soon as possible, so we'll figure out what we can get to go to sleep as soon as possible, run that, that's going to be the shortest CPU burst. Another way of thinking about it is that we want to minimize the amount of time where we have two threads waiting by taking the shorter of the two whenever we have a choice. While they're both not finished, we're going to have to wait. If we want to get out of the situation where we have any two threads waiting, we'll choose the shorter of those two threads to run to get it out of the way. And it turns out also that if we want the worst turnaround time, running the longest CPU burst first is going to do that. Though probably that's not a goal we'll have. So later, we're going to use this result in probably a way you could come up with some ways of using this result. We're going to do a particular example of how we can use this result to make a scheduler that minimizes mean turnaround time. But first, a diversion. So I'm going to talk about a different scheduling goal for a bit, to talk about a very different kind of scheduler that is going to be a useful building block for actually building a scheduler that minimizes mean turnaround time. And this scheduling goal is unlike the metrics we've talked about before, and this is where we have like a system administrator who has particular preferences. So for example, I have a system, a big share computer, and I might decide, we have users who are logging into the system and doing stuff, and we have people who are running these big, long computations. People who are running the big, long computations don't really complain to me when those computations take a bit longer, but boy do people complain when their shell takes 30 seconds for them to press a key. So I want to make sure those shells run even if those computations are running. I want those to have what we'll call priority. Or another example might be, faculty can actually do something about my job. I better make sure the computing system works well for them. And the students, well, they don't really have any power, so I'm just going to not run their stuff if that means the faculty stuff runs better. So our scheduling algorithm for this is we'll schedule the more important thing always before the less important thing. So we'll run the shells before the big computations so no one complains that it took me, you know, 3 seconds to see my key press, because the shell will run fast. And we'll run the faculty programs first so they won't notice that the system is really slow, no matter what those students are doing. And the classic scheduler that implements this is known as a priority scheduler. So we'll have a bunch of what I'll call priority levels, and we'll usually have a ready queue for each one. So rather than having one ready queue, one set of runnable tasks, we'll divide them up into these priorities, and we'll have a separate queue for each. And in each priority level, we'll choose a particular scheduling algorithm. Usually, we'll use something like round robin. And how we're going to schedule is we're going to say, I need to run something. What I'm going to choose, I'm going to start with the highest priority. And here I'm saying the highest priority is 15. That might not always be how people number them. And I'm going to run something at priority 15. And that's how I'm going to make my decision every time. That I'm going to look at the highest priority first, and only if I don't find something at priority 15, and I'm going to start going down to priority 3 and 2 and so on. So I'm giving an example here where we have these multiple queues. You could have each process have a unique priority and maybe have like one big priority queue, but typically we have multiple queues because we're in this sort of situation where it's like it's a shell or it isn't. So we have to manage the shells as sort of equally important. So it makes sense to put them in one big queue. Okay, so questions? Yes. Now, priority scheduling is typically preemptive. So this means that if a higher priority program comes along, we're going to run it immediately. So we're going to have to remember when programs aren't ready what priority they should have somehow, or figure it out when they become runnable. And you know, when it becomes along, we're going to switch to it immediately. So like if I'm running a big computation and one of those shells becomes runnable because I pressed a key, priority scheduler, if it's preemptive, which usually they are, we're going to run that shell right away. Doesn't matter what the computation was doing. That's typically what we want, because if we didn't do that, like, we aren't really giving the shells priority. Like, they have sort of priority. So let's think about how priority scheduling ends up working with this scenario. Say I have thread A running at highest priority, and what it does is it does 1 unit of I.O. and then 10 units of CPU, then 1 unit of I.O., then 10 units of CPU. It's just doing this in a loop forever. And we have thread Z, which is our big computation. It runs at the lowest priority because, you know, we don't care about the computations very much. And it has to do 400 units of CPU, then it's done. Just doing big computation. The question is, how long will Z take to complete? I'll give you a minute or so. Check with your neighbor, see if you agree on the calculation. Okay. Who would like more time? So then does someone have an answer they're willing to share? What number do you think? Way back there. So the question is, like, so you're saying, well, if thread A was runnable all the time, then it would take forever, okay. But you said there's unit of I.O., and indeed that unit of I.O. is the issue. And I'm trying to say in the problem that it's one unit of I.O., then 10 units of CPU, then one unit of I.O., then 10 units of CPU. Does someone have, like, a number based on that? But you're right that, like, we didn't have that I.O. Yeah.
44,000 units, because one out of every 11 units.
Yeah. So you're saying one out of every 11. So what happens is we run A for 10 units, and then we run B, well, A is doing I.O. for one unit. Then we run A for 10 units, then B while A is doing I.O. So every 11 units of time, we get one unit of B's work done in A's I.O. So we end up with 44K, one unit for 11 units of time. Okay, so questions about how we figured that out? So now I have a second example here. So I have the same thread A, so it does 10 units of CPU, then it needs one unit of I.O., then it does 10 units of CPU, needs one unit of I.O., and you should probably think of this I.O. as something like accessing a disk. So because it waits until the CPU is done. I didn't say it needs I.O. every so much time, and B has the same pattern. It needs 10 units of I.O., then one unit. So 10 units of CPU, then one unit of I.O., and repeats this. And then we also have Z. Now, how long will thread Z take to complete? I'll give you a minute, you can check with your neighbor. Okay, who would like some more time? Okay, so someone have an answer that they, or approximate answer they'd like to share? No volunteers. Yeah. Forever. So why forever?
Because whenever, like as a general rule, whenever A sort of opens up its CPU, B will be using it. There's like one little unit at the beginning when I think like both A and B are trying to do the I/O, so that only B will compute. But I don't think it ever opens up again.
So your observation is like, we have one place at the beginning when A and B both do I/O. Great. Z gets one unit of work done. But after that, for Z to be able to do work, we need to have A do I/O. And while that's happening, B is also doing I/O. But with this pattern, that's not actually possible. Because if we think of running A finishes, and then B runs for a little bit, well, B is going to need to run for at least one unit of time, which means that by the time B is done, or by the time A is done with its I/O, B will either have just started its I/O, not give a Z a chance to run, or not started its I/O. You know, so we'll never end up with a chance with this exact time. Now, if the timings were slightly different, you know, like, you know, we edited these numbers so they weren't multiples of each other, so it was like 1.01 and, you know, 1.02 or something like that, then we'd have a different situation, and it would just take Z an incredibly long time, because it would get almost no chance to run, but occasionally it would get really lucky and that timing would work out, so they'd A and B's I/O would overlap for like half a unit of time, you know, once every 1,000 units of time or something like that. But it would be very rare. So this is an example of what we call starvation. That we have a program Z which is getting starved of resources. And this is what everyone agrees is not fair. You know, Z is, from a fairness perspective, clearly this is a bad schedule. And this is why I talked about a fairness metric, is not because we're going to usually be super concerned about getting the optimal fairness, but because we want to avoid situations like this where we have a program which either never runs or essentially never runs. And this is a problem with things like priority schedulers. Well, arguably a problem. Like, the scheduler is doing exactly what I asked it to. I asked it to like run faculty programs first. It's doing that, just never running the student programs. Because that's exactly what I told it. But people often find out that maybe that's not really what they meant. So that's a bit of a little diversion. So we've seen priority schedulers. We've seen this problem priority schedulers have of starvation. We'll get back to that later when we apply priority schedulers. And we're going to start by applying priority schedulers to our first-come, first-served case. So I told you that the best order was you're on the shortest CPU burst first. Well, the priority scheduler is a good tool for doing that. We just set our priority based on our CPU burst length and use a priority scheduler. So we can use this generic sort of scheduler mechanism that's useful for other things to implement that. I'm going to start out by looking at this without preemption. We'll add preemption later, but adding preemption is going to be a bit tricky in that if we add preemption and keep the same priority setting the same, it's not actually going to work the way we want. Now, this idea seems relatively simple. So priority, you know, is CPU burst based on the CPU burst length. So shorter CPU bursts have a higher priority. So we can set that up, you know, assign numbers based on the CPU burst length, except we have to know what's the CPU burst length. And in my examples, it was easy. You read the slide, there's the CPU burst length. But that doesn't exactly work inside an operating system. You know, so how do we do that? We're going to come to this problem, but it's a problem. And we're not really going to solve it. We're going to almost sort of kind of solve it. So let's look at what this scheduling does. Shortest job first. And I'm going to say I have three programs which all do this CPU, then I/O, CPU, then I/O pattern. And since this is a fixed pattern, we can just assign priorities. This is the highest, this is the and the lowest priority. And that's how we're going to run them. And we're saying we start with the CPU. So if they're all runnable at the same time, then I'm going to run the highest priority first, then the medium priority, then the lowest. So here's the schedule I get. I run the highest priority first, then the next highest that's still runnable, then the lowest. And these arrows here represent the I/O operation. So I'm saying I started an I/O for program B here, and it finished here. And because I'm not doing preemption yet, I'm deciding not to run B right away. Now, it seems like running B right away would actually help our turnaround time here. And indeed it would. I also have a case of C finishing its I/O and running C right away. Well, we wouldn't do that with preemption because B has a higher priority. So that seems right so far, too. So this seems pretty close to what we want, except that, you know, except for not doing preemption. And it seems like, okay, so you should add preemption. Right. That seems to be the case. That we just do this, add preemption, and it will be great. And we can see that, like, we really want preemption here because, well, I just finished B, and I'd sure have B weighed a whole lot less if it ran right away, and I make A weigh relatively not much more, you know, given when B finishes I/O here. We still have that convoy effect that was a problem with first come, first served, but even though we're ordering, because we don't have preemption. So it seems like we just add preemption. And preemption will solve this problem of, oh, I started running A, but it turned out that something much more urgent came along, you know, and I should run that. And the reason it's more urgent is because running it, it will finish quickly. Therefore, to minimize turnaround time, we should run it earlier. So let's think about adding preemption. So it seems like it just, great. Long job's running, short job interrupts it. The short job was wait for too long if we don't interrupt it. Right decision. Just reschedule when the job arrives. But what about we have some long tack CPU burst that's almost done running, and then something kind of long, but not as long, comes around. In this case, we don't actually want to run the medium thing right away. We don't want to give it higher priority because we're almost done with that long thing. Even though it's so long, we're going to, you know, if we just waited like an extra unit of time, it would finish. Versus if we run that medium thing, we'll be waiting a while for both things to finish of extra time. So we're not doing our original goal of going racing to sleep. We aren't putting things to sleep, having them stop waiting for the CPU as soon as possible by choosing to run the shorter CPU burst, because our current CPU burst is almost done. So the solution to this is that our priority shouldn't be how long the CPU bursts are. That shouldn't determine our priority. But instead, we need to take into account that we've already done some work. So it should be how long they have left. So we should look at, well, we've gotten this far. What do we have left? And this gives us the actual scheduler we want for this, which is shortest remaining time first. So we're going to choose the thing which has the least work left to do, because we're not going to undo the work that was already done. And we want to not do the wrong thing in this situation where we're almost done, but we don't want to delay something that's almost done for new work that's going to take longer than that almost done thing would take to finish. So we can see this example with this same schedule. So here I have C running, and at this point I say, okay, B is ready now, it finishes I/O, and A is running. But B is going to take less time than A has left. So we do run B right away. But later on, when C finishes, while A is running, we say A does take longer overall than C, but A has a lot less work to do than C would need to do. So we keep running A at this next point in time. Because finishing A is faster than finishing C. And we went to run the thing which will finish first, not the thing which takes the least time to finish. Okay, so questions? About how this works. Yeah. If I prioritize shortest remaining time first, but nothing has started first, isn't it the same? Yes. Yes, and that's why like we didn't notice a difference when we had no preemption, because when there's no preemption, like we're only looking when things are just starting, so it's the same. So they're the same in that case. So the remaining part only matters when we're preempting things. Okay. Other questions? So I've given sort of an intuitive argument for this being a good schedule for minimizing remaining time. And I also had my option with preemption, which I called shortest job first, that I said was good without preemption. Yeah. So you're asking about this line here?
Yeah.
This is saying that B and A's I/O finish at the same time. So both B and A are ready at the same time, and we run B, because B's shorter. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. So it turns out that people who've actually done the math, that if you wanted to do proofs on this, which we won't do because I not have a real unit on queuing theory, that shortest job first minimizes, I should write down here, this is turnaround time, because I wanted to not use the word response to not be confusing. So shortest job first, that is the non-preemptive version, minimizes turnaround time if you disallow preemption and also disallow leaving the CPU idle. So you might say, wait, leaving the CPU idle? So one thing we could imagine doing is we could say, well, something that's not going to take very long is going to finish soon, so let's delay starting that long A thing. That is a thing you could do to do better than like the shortest job first example I showed you, that would avoid the convoy effect. But it's not really an option for a typical OS, first of all, because we don't actually know when things are going to finish their I/O, and secondly, because usually the proposition of deliberately don't use the CPU is a non-starter. But if you ignore those two options, then it's the best you can do, pretty much. And more strongly, shortest remaining time first minimizes turnaround and waiting time, total or mean, if you ignore context switch costs. So if you don't ignore context switch costs, things get way more complicated. But if you assume context switching is free, that you can do it as much as you need to without any cost, then this is the minimum turnaround time schedule. And this is actually provable, and it doesn't matter, in fact, what the sort of pattern of the programs you're running are. Like, to a large extent, it's the minimum turnaround time schedule. Okay, so questions? about these results. Okay, so an aside on names. So I'm going to try to use the term SRTF for the preemptive algorithm with remaining time, shortest remaining time first, and the term SJF for shortest job first for the non-preemptive algorithm with, you know, total time equals remaining time. They're the same because it's not preemptive and that we're only measuring when things start. In the literature, including some of our textbooks, you might see different names. The biggest thing is that some people call both of these shortest job first, which I think, you know, isn't the best name because it's good to remember about how why it's remaining time and not total time. But you might just see the different names elsewhere. Okay, so that's shortest remaining time first. Seems like a great algorithm, except we can't implement it. We need to know the CPU burst lengths, and that seems hard, and it is hard. So we're going to think about solutions for that. That's going to be our next topic. So one thing we could do is we could say, okay, we could ask. And some batch scheduling systems do this. They say, if you want to run something, you know, want to run your simulation, tell me how long you need. Like, do you need 2-3 hours? Write that down. And sometimes users even tell you a correct answer or an answer which is like within 50% of correct. Sometimes. But this is not really an option for our CPU scheduling thing. Like when you write a program, you know, you don't add code which says, I'm processing this key press, it's going to take 5 milliseconds. And that would be very inconvenient. And not something which really fits with our programming model. And you could say, okay, maybe there's something else we could use, but none of this information really gets you there. Like you could say, we could look at like whether it has the keyboard open or the screen open from the open files, but that's sort of a hint. It doesn't actually give us a number. And we want a number. And in general, well, if we want to figure out how long the CPU burst is, we need to run the program. Like we don't have another solution, otherwise we're solving the halting problem. So we literally, you know, there's no other way of doing it. But we're going to use heuristics. And when I say heuristics, you should think things that don't always work or often don't work. But we're going to use heuristics to make a good guess, a hopefully good guess. And our heuristics are going to be based on this observation, which is usually true, that CPU bursts I see now are like CPU bursts later. If something is behaving like a shell and doing a little bit of computation in response to key presses now, that's probably what it's going to be doing later. You know, if something's acting like doing this long bunches of CPU to like do some big calculation now, it's probably going to be doing that in 5 seconds from now or even minutes from now. And we're going to use that to actually predict this, that interactive programs are still going to be interactive programs, you know, in a couple seconds or a couple minutes, and CPU-heavy programs are probably still going to be CPU-heavy in a couple minutes. This won't always be true, but it's what we're going to take advantage of. So I'm going to talk about one strategy, one concrete strategy. I'm going to introduce it today, and we'll finish talking about it next time, that tries to both do this prediction and apply these predictions to approximate that shortest remaining time first. And this is something called multi-level feedback queues. So this is going to be based on priority scheduling. So we'll have multiple queues, one for each priority level, like I saw with my priority example. And we're going to combine sort of updating the time estimates with running shorter things first. The key idea is that our priority is going to be our current time estimate. So when we want to run something later, we'll change our time estimate by changing its priority. And we're going to group things into a small number of buckets, that's priority levels. And this is actually pretty fine because even though doing the optimal schedule involves figuring out the exact CPU burst times, what we really care about is separating out the things which are going to take a ton of time for the CPU burst versus a short time. You know, that's what we really want to separate. So a small number of buckets is going to do most of the work. Yes, we could eke out the last few percent by being more precise, but if you think about like the examples I started with for first come, first serve, we want to make separate A from B and C. We don't care so much about whether we figure out that C is shorter than B, but we really care that we figure out that A is longer than B and C. And that's what we're going to try to do. And the key insight with multi-level feedback cues is that in addition to setting the priority based on the time estimate, we're going to enforce that by setting a time quantum based on the priority level. So that we say, well, if I think you need 1 millisecond, I'm going to give you 1 millisecond. And we're going to, based on that, be able to see, was my estimate correct? And if my estimate's wrong, you'll exceed that amount of time I give at that priority level, and we'll take corrective action. So within each of these priority levels, we'll run round robin, but with a different time slice. So at priority 3, the highest priority here, I'm saying we're estimating you need 0 to 1 millisecond, so I'm going to run you for about a millisecond. So I'll run thread A for a millisecond, then thread B for a millisecond. And if you need that whole millisecond, I'll know, maybe there's something wrong with my estimate. And I'll set other time slices at these different rates. So for priority 2 in this case, I'm going to say you're 1 to 10 milliseconds. So I'm going to enforce that if you take longer than 10 milliseconds, I'm going to do something about that. So in this way, we not only correct our estimates, we also limit the impact of bad estimates. If I put something which really needs 10 seconds of CPU at priority 3, it's not going to be a big deal, because I'm going to immediately say, well, you took more than 1 millisecond, let's fix that, before this like keeps everything else from running. Okay, so questions about this setup here, and the idea of having different time slices at each priority. Okay, so our basic algorithm. So I have an example here. We have priority, and I've set a CPU burst length. So my estimate for 3 is that it's 0 to 1 millisecond time slice. So I set a 1 millisecond limit. If you use more than 1 millisecond, we do something. We stop running you right away. And I have 10, 20, and 100. These are arbitrary choices. You know, and we're doing round robin. But we're going to do something different when something finishes. So we're always going to start by running the highest priority thing. And if it uses the whole time slice, well, our estimate's bad. So we want to fix that. And if it uses the whole time slice, that means it's at too high a priority. So we're going to lower its priority now. We're just going to shift it down to the lower priority. And if it finishes early, maybe that's a sign that it could need less than a millisecond. So we'll experimentally increase its priority. And if our guess is wrong, then it might be faster. It will go back down, and it's not a big deal. So this is a very simple way of managing that. And this will, you know, get us to approximately the right location. I said these are already coarse-grained buckets. But our real purpose is to separate these things which need, you know, many, like almost 100 milliseconds from the things which need like a few. And this is going to be effective at that by using history. Okay, so we'll talk more about this next time. So we'll finish up today.